Back to paper one. Section four. Old single column, page 26. All right, well, let's just jump right in here. I don't think we need any preface. This is kind of continuing directly with what we were doing last week. Like I mentioned last week, you have the focus on personality in the latter part of the paper. So you can see that's the next section that we get into that block. So they've got a little bit more kind of in the mode that we were in last time, where they're still very much putting some of the basic things forward and trying to get us to take that newer perspective into account. If you're a new reader and you're trying to understand this expanded revelation of the nature of God, how does that relate to the thoughts that I've had historically? And so again, we'll see them using biblical quotes like they're doing quite a bit, or him, see the divine counselor use biblical quotes as a easy way to grab a hold of you where you are. Now, of course, if you don't know the Bible at all, they're kind of out of the blue. But that's another reason why the Bible quotes are so significantly massaged. So you can just take them, at face value, and they're speaking the truth that he's trying to convey. But there's also a lot to how he's modified them, giving you suggestion about how to reorient your thinking. Take the old, look at his new, think about the transformation between the two. He's trying to give you assistance in that reformation process by just appreciating that differential between the literal quote and the tweaked quote that he is always using. So let's jump right in, Steve.
For the mystery of God. The infinity of the perfection of God is such that it eternally constitutes him mystery. And the greatest of all the unfathomable mysteries of God is the phenomenon of the divine indwelling of mortal minds. The manner in which the universal Father sojourns with the creatures of time is the most profound of all universe mysteries. The divine presence in the mind of man is the mystery of mysteries.
Okay, let's pause on that one. Now, everyone remembers that. It's the point where they really throw that mystery of mysteries line out that we so often invoke. Now, but let's appreciate what he's saying is mysterious so that we don't take the statement too far. What's mysterious is the direct rational understanding part of it. What do we have? We literally have a fragment of the infinite, directly within and engaging the lowliest of personal finite minds. You can't bridge a bigger gap in the universe in terms of that which personality is engaging. You got like we're going to talk about and coming up in the next section, personality at the highest level, somehow without any intervening phenomenon directly in contact with personality at the lowest level. So that's a mystery of mysteries. It's not just a mystery, it's a mystery of mysteries because it's the biggest gap possible. Okay, and the mystery is just how do you understand that rationally, how that plugs in, how can that work? Shouldn't there be just completely no engaging in that sort of a mode? So even though it's very mysterious in terms of a literal rational understanding, it's quite easy to begin to recognize that it's not illogical that this is happening. Even if I can't understand it rationally in any way, it's quite easy to begin to see that it's not illogical. You know, so that logical recognition that you can bring to bear on a statement like this. That's what you want to make sure that you don't, overinterpret, a statement like this. It's like, well, it's not even worth it. Trying to think about it. They're telling me it's impossible to do anything, so I just turn my brain off. That's the last thing you want to do. You want to always be trying to take delight in cultivating greater objective consciousness. So how can you go at this logically? Well, we've mentioned one way a number of times, over the last few years, that one of the things that's kind of mysterious here is, okay, I'm calling this a pure spirit fragment, this influence that's in my mind, but then they turn right around and tell me, do you realize just how material, inertia'd, impeded your mind is, how material-like your mind is? Okay, so that's part of the mystery, is that extreme differential between very, very material and very, very spiritual. However, just as much as the adjuster is pure spirit, it's also pure energy. You turn it around, it's pure energy. So just recognizing that one little fact about an adjuster, it's like, maybe it's not quite as inscrutable as I thought. I mean, because if there's just as much pure energy to the adjuster's nature as pure spirit, that pure energy probably has some mechanism to engage my very material mind. Okay. But let's take it a notch further than that. Let's really bring in what we tried to stress so much as we were going through the Supreme Papers. This very fundamental aspect of reality that we've been working on, really bringing into our thinking more, that there's always this bidirectional flow going on in our reality. So think about this. You've got an adjuster. We've recognized that adjuster is a fragment of the infinite upholder. That it's that aspect of the Father that is being individuated and brought down to us. The infinite upholder. Okay, so that's the infinite upholder is the name from the unity viewpoint. If you turn that around and look at it from the individuality viewpoint, so that you think of that not as a facet of deity, but as a reservoir of potential. What's the name of that reservoir? The universal absolute, right? And the universal absolute is the reservoir, literally, for the mind energy. So think about this. See, from the bottom up view, from the individuality viewpoint, you're literally the mind where your energy that your consciousness is in. That mind energy has been actualized up out of the potential, out of the reservoir of the universal absolute. So there's this upwelling mind energy coming out of the universal absolute. But from the unity viewpoint, that's the infinite upholder, and there's a fragment of that infinite upholder. It's going down to engage you as the thought adjuster. You have the mind energy upwelling, the adjuster downwelling, and the two meet. That's just like with this, when we're talking about the Supreme. We recognize that you had all three of the reservoirs, the unqualified absolute, the deity absolute, and the universal absolute, those three reservoirs of potential were being actualized under the influence of the supreme creators and the supreme controllers. And that was giving rise not only to, you and I coming up out of those potentials, but the supreme creators in relationship to that phenomenon were creating... we're instrumental in creating this reflection of that phenomenon as the Almighty. You know, the Almighty is that upwelling phenomenon out of those three absolutes, unqualified absolute, the deity absolute, and the universal absolute. Okay, so those three things giving rise to the Almighty.
But what's the Almighty on this?
It's not on there.
Look in the other
chart,
the psychic.
Okay.
Circles. Look here. So now turn it around. Look at it from the unity viewpoint. Instead of those three absolute reservoirs, I've got three facets of deity. I have the infinite capacity, the infinite potential, and the infinite upholder. The association of those three facets of deity downstepped is the mother. It's how the mother, you know, has those three attributes always. And we talk about, like, you know, say, womb focalizer and upholder, for instance, you know, or totality attitude, coordinate actor, cosmic overcontroller. You know, that threefold character we always talk about with the mother comes from that threefold association of deity. So, see, you've got the exact same thing. From the individuality viewpoint, you have the Almighty upwelling out of those three things from the individuality viewpoint, those three absolutes. From the unity viewpoint, you have the association of three, and you have a downwelling phenomenon, the mother. The Almighty is going up, the mother is going down, and the two meet. Okay? The superadditive consequence of the relationship between your upwelling mind and that downwelling adjuster is going back to you, right? We'll get to that in a second. Your upwelling mind and the downwelling adjuster, just you as an individual, the superadditive consequence of that relationship is your soul. Right. I mean, a father and a mother of the soul, right? I mean, we talk about that. One is the father, one's the mother of the soul. You know, and it's a warp and a woof, you know, the material and the spiritual get woven together. It's a superadditive consequence. Okay, when you have now go to yours. See, you have the upwelling Almighty and the downwelling Mother, and the superadditive consequence of the relationship between those two is the Supreme. Well, just, you know, we're just talking about the deity, so just the Supreme. And, you know, who do we call the Supreme Being when we think about that transcendent, you know, absentite individual, the Supreme Being? We call him the Oversoul of creation. Right? This is the parallel. Okay? You have an upwelling and a downwelling. If you can understand you can understand the Supreme. If you can understand the Supreme, you can understand yourself. It's the exact same thing. There's an upwelling and a downwelling. And what's, you know, what you're upwelling out of and what you're downwelling from is the same thing, only from the unity viewpoint and the individuality viewpoint. It's the universal absolute or it's the infinite upholder. Both are true. And it gives rise to the two. Okay. So when you think about it like that, it's like, well, okay, this isn't very mysterious at all, that there would be a relationship between my mind and the thought adjuster. They come from the exact same place. The infinite upholder, the universal absolute, it's the same thing, only from the two different viewpoints. Is it surprising, logically, that there would be an intimate association between the two? How could there not be? Okay. See, so logically, it's very...
There's no mystery in the logic.
Yeah, right. It's rock solid logically. Now, the precise technical details of how that happens, I mean, you know, none of us are going to explain that. But logically, it's very straightforward. That's what it's a great example of the kind of thing that you're looking for, you know, in engaging the revelation at a new level. Don't let your rational limitations hold you back. You've been given a great and divine gift, the Holy Spirit, that allows you to transcend your adjutant limitations, even your Maranja mind limitations. Objective character will always be there, allowing you to always be able to transcend your subjective limitations, even when you're in Havona. You'll have subjective limitations there, but you'll always have connection to that which is objective and higher, that you can use to, you know, get a firm grip, a grip on reality in spite of your inability to, you know, somehow just, you know, think it through deductively. Okay. Rationalize it out. Just recognize. Yeah. And then the extent to which you can rationalize, fine. But always recognize, and always recognize before you rationalize, and if you can't rationalize, still recognize. I mean, recognize. That's the key. Discover, recognize.
We're not in the adjuster's mind.
No.
We don't have that ability.
But the adjuster is in our mind.
It's in our mind, and it's sending out signals.
You know, it stands as a reference point of form. You know, if you want to know what harmony looks like, you can take delight in cultivating, you know, greater and greater insight to recognize the cosmos and see the harmony there and bring that in. But like I've said just recently, wouldn't it be wonderful if there was a condensation of that universal harmony right in front of my face, right within my mind, that would help catalyze this? Just, you know,
even brings together the three cosmic intuitions.
Right. It helps you with that
one.
That harmonizing of them, because it's you know, it begins as an existential, you know, unity, and perfect harmony is the only thing that can be built around that existential unity. So that experiential part of the adjuster that you actually engage is perfect harmony. You know, listen to it. Listen to its, you know, chords. Listen to the melody of the adjuster. You know, and again, you know, when I say that, you're not trying to listen to it literally consciously. You're trying to supply the favorable conditions so that it can work in your superconsciousness, and those things can slowly, you know, be brought down into your consciousness with you having no direct conscious linkage or communication with the adjuster. You know, the problem with the adjuster has right now is you just refuse to supply favorable conditions for its effort. You always want to be creating, you know, I want to take grip of my mind and do it my way. And then the adjuster, you know, can't do anything, you know. So supplying the favorable conditions for the adjuster.
Yeah. Can we just a minute stop and take an inventory of all the minds that we have in us? Mm-hmm. Because we have, from what I've gathered, we've got human mind, which is what we're talking about. We have mechanical mind.
Well,
and the adjutant spirit minds, or adjutant mind spirits, and then the morontial mind, which
now,
is the soul.
You have, there's three minds. You know, your mind as a person, you only have one right now.
Right.
You know, that mortal mind, you know, it has many facets. It has mechanical mind, seven adjutants. It's a many-faceted mind, but it's all one mind. It's not like, you know, your adjutant mind is a different mind than your mechanical mind. It's all together as one mind. So you have that mortal mind. Your soul, there's morontia mind, connected to your soul, but now you don't, as a person, are not connected to that. But that mind that's connected to that soul, it does make decisions, you know, and we've talked about that. If you supply the favorable conditions in your mortal mind, in your adjutant mind, you know, you can slowly over time begin to develop a little bit of resonance with that other mind, and it'll help as a catalyst for creating harmony in your mind. But you're not going to shift over to that mind until, you know, you're going out of for a circular mode. You know, and then there's the adjuster is minded as well. So there's three minds, three sets of decisions in play. The adjuster is working to get those three sets of deciding minds harmonized. And the adjuster very much is hoping that you will supply the favorable conditions to make that happen, because it doesn't have a personality. It can't just will that into existence. Only your personality actually has the pattern essential to that harmonization. You know, and obviously you're not going to complete, you know, none of us are going to complete that in this life. So we die, you know, the mortal mind's gone. We're resurrected. We have a morontia mind and the adjuster mind. So now there's two minds. And the adjuster is still doing what it was trying to do before. It's trying to still, you know, get those two minds harmonized. When it gets them fully harmonized, diffuse. And again, your personality is essential for the favorable conditions for that. Because the personality is what transcends all of this complexity and can bring harmony out of all that separateness.
Okay, so the agitate mind spirits, they're part of the one mind that we have. But they're part of mortal mind.
Yeah, they're part of your mortal mind. Yeah, when I see...
from the Supreme or the Infinite?
No, it's from the Creative Mother Spirit. It's her mind, really. You know, it's her mind energy, and you're utilizing it.
I'd like to make one point.
Yep.
Why would not God not indwell the lowliest of creatures? Because it'd be like a mother leaving her baby. Nobody would do that, you know, especially a loving God. So of course he's going to be indwelling us. So to me, it's kind of not a mystery.
Right. I mean, right. There's that simple recognition that. That he's thinking. I mean, there's lots of beings that don't have adjusters. See, so you know, there's that issue. Yeah. See, and that brings in a little complication. But certainly, in you know, from our you know our initial viewpoint, you know, we see it very much in that. Well, I would be orphaned. You know, if that were you know, wasn't the case. I mean, that's what you're getting at. And so, you know, that's a valid recognition from our human vantage point.
They say in the book somewhere that if all the adjusters were taken away on this planet, we'd be down to a primitive level again.
Yeah, sure.
Savage.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So anyway, just so you get the idea. That's the kind of, you know, recognition that we can now bring to bear. Now that we're comfortable with talking about things from both the unity and the individuality viewpoint, you know, you can begin to bring in a much greater ease of relationship to, you know, how you can begin to actually think about this mystery of mysteries. All right, so now look what comes next here. Another thing that we bring up a lot.
The physical bodies of mortals are the temples of God. Notwithstanding that the sovereign creator sons come near the creatures of their inhabited worlds and draw all men to themselves, though they stand at the door of consciousness and knock, and delight to come in to all who will open the doors of their hearts, although there does exist this intimate personal communion between the creator sons and their mortal creatures, nevertheless, mortal men have something from God himself which actually dwells within them. Their bodies are the temples thereof.
Okay. So, you know, I often speak to this. Now, here's where they're trying to make it very, you know, give you this very directly so that you make this linkage. And he's even using his tweaking of Bible passages to foster this. And if you go to, you know, the book of Revelation, you know, that he's quoting from there with the whole stand at the door and knock, you know, open the doors. Okay. He's added their hearts, of their hearts. Okay, he's added that because he wants you. He's invoking the temple of God, you know, the temple within, and he's saying that temple within, that's the true heart that you humans have invoked for so many ages. You know, you've talked about your heart. Okay, and you've been struggling trying to rationalize that notion and not getting very far in a lot of cases. You know, being satisfied with a pretty materialistic, you know, understanding of that notion. You know, the temple within, literally the heart, the core of your being, the true heart, is this space within where the adjuster dwells. You know, and we've talked about that many times. That's you know, easily visualizable in our hourglass picture. We've got the lower domain of our subjective consciousness. It's, you know, those first three levels of meaning, you know, established by the agitant mind, you know, getting us just up to the neck. But then up in that upper domain of the hourglass, there's space there. There's, you know, there's a domain there because there's three more levels of meaning established by the Holy Spirit, by the three cosmic intuitions. You know, push the ceiling up, create a space. First, second, third cosmic intuitions. That upper domain, that's the temple. That's your true heart. Yeah.
When do you get through that little aperture?
Well, yeah. But that is it. I mean, right. I mean, the third level of meaning is the level of patience. So, it's when you begin to be able to transition from arrows that are always pointing in towards you to getting it neutralized, to now thinking about turning the arrow outward. Okay, now you're moving up into the upper domain. You know, kindness, mercy, love. Okay, they're talking about the, you know, not only the adjuster, but you notice they purposely invoke the Spirit of Truth here too. You know, again, that there's no place for the adjuster to dwell within, and there's no place that the Spirit of Truth can engage without that temple. The temple is the point where the Spirit of Truth engages. It doesn't engage, you know, your adjutant mind. It engages the temple. And you have to give it permission. You know, the whole, you know, you open the door. Remember, the Spirit of Truth, his effectiveness is almost totally limited by your choice to let it in. Okay, just like they're, you know, using the Bible passages to remind you of there. Okay, so, I mean, the adjuster is just stuck in there, you know, and you're hoping it's not a prison. It just gets crammed in there. The smaller the space, the more crammed in it is. Okay, but that's the temple, okay? So, see how that was done right up here in paper one. They try to bring in that literal notion of the temple, getting you to use the word heart in this very definitive new way before you go through the rest of the book. You know, so imagine, you know, if you're trying to understand the Jesus papers, and all over in the Jesus papers you see him using the word heart, and you interpret that word in the light of human, past human use of that word. Are you going to have more or less distortion of meaning? More. You know, if you haven't taken to heart what's up here in paper one first, you don't know what they're talking about. You know, they don't mean really anything that humans have thought about. They mean something very literal and something very advanced relative to human historical understanding. We're talking, you know, it's sad to record that so few persons have any notion of the true heart. They have lots of notions of, you know, the imaginary heart. You know, I want to be in heart. But the true heart takes, you have to take delight in cultivating a relationship with the true heart.
When you know, I feel myself off of my heart,
mm-hmm.
and you can start to feel that in your physiology, you know,
yeah.
if you stay off long enough. And it ultimately does go to your beating heart.
Yeah. And you know, that kind of ties in with what she was, you know, getting at, but bringing about the facets of mind. I mean, obviously. The only reason that subjective mind has any integrity is because it's connected to objective mind. You don't have to be conscious up there, but there's an energetic connection nonetheless. You know, you have sane adjutant mind because of its connection to the Holy Spirit. If you unplug the Holy Spirit, you know, or you get yourself so moved away from any of those higher domains, your adjutant mind is going to start to, you know, unravel a bit. And the more your adjutant mind unravels, the more your mechanical mind unravels. And the more your mechanical mind unravels, the more your body physiologically unravels. I mean, it comes down. Yeah. Sanity is not innate in agitant mind. The only reason agitant mind is sane is because it's connected to something above. If you force it to be disconnected from things above, then your mind will go steadily insane.
What's coming to me in this concept of opening your heart is something that it works for me quite a lot, is just to stop resisting. I think our hearts naturally want to open up. I think there's that within us that just wants to receive, and then there's this resistance that we impose on it. And so just sometimes, rather than thinking of it as a forceful act, I have to open my heart,
right.
Just stop resisting.
Supply the favorable conditions. See, I keep stressing this. Stop trying to be a creator being. There already is a creator being. It's not more than one. There's several creator beings in contact with you. You don't need any more creator beings within. There's plenty already. Stop resisting them. Stop resisting the creative Mother Spirit. All you have to do is let it be. That's why those are words of wisdom. Okay? Let it be.
Go with the flow.
Supply the favorable conditions, which at their core, at their foundation, are humility and patience. If you just supply those favorable conditions, you'll be vastly ahead of almost every single person on the planet. We can start talking about more advanced favorable conditions if you've got those firmly, in process. If you're still struggling to be patient, once every 5 years, forget about anything more advanced. It's impossible. The adjuster is locked in a little thimble-sized prison, and there's just nothing going to happen until you die. supply the favorable conditions. Okay, so there's the temple. They're giving you permission to take possession of those words, temple and heart, and use them with a new clarity now going forward. And if you're in a conversation and people are real fuzzy on that, try to bring some clarity to that. Get them to feel that as a literal fact, not a bunch of wishful thinking. And certainly not, most of the time what people call the heart is the level of feelings. Okay? That's way down below the heart, the true heart.
More distortion.
Yeah. It's just a level of feelings. That's not the heart. All right.
When you are through down here, when your course has been run in temporary form on earth, when your trial trip in the flesh is finished, when the dust that composes the mortal tabernacle returns to the earth whence it came, then it is revealed, the indwelling spirit shall return to God who gave it. There sojourns within each mortal being of this planet a fragment of God, a part and parcel of divinity. It is not yet yours by right of possession, but it is designedly intended to be one with you if you survive the mortal existence.
Okay, well, that's pretty straightforward. There's one little thing I just want to point out with the use of the quotes there. This is a real important passage in the Bible that is really not appreciated. Notice that statement. That's pretty much directly out of Ecclesiastes, right? At the end of Ecclesiastes, you've got this statement, the Spirit shall return to God who gave it. Just like that, it says that. And they're saying, recognize that sentence. You've got that clear back in the Old Testament in Ecclesiastes. It's right there. Okay? Now, just to challenge you to not fuzzy that statement, which humans have been wont to do forever, he purposely capitalized the S. This is his one little tweak. If you go look that up, you'll see lowercase s. He purposely capitalized it as a challenge against the fuzziness of human rationalizing. Because there's a strong tendency for people historically to interpret that as, well, you know, that's that old primitive thing, stuff they call the heart, you know, that they actually meant the breath. Mm-hmm. And they're just talking about the breath there.
The spirit means
literally. Okay. And if you go to the, matter of fact, if you go to the New Revised Standard Version, you'll see that it doesn't even say spirit anymore. It says breath. The New Revised Standard Version, you know, one of the most recent Bibles, has actually taken that next step and just put breath in there instead of spirit. Okay, and you say, well, how dare they do that? Well, I mean, they can go to the beginning of Ecclesiastes and they can see a very similar statement where they're talking about breath and then they're talking about the spirit, and they're going, well, see, they're the same thing. I mean, even it even says so in Ecclesiastes. Sure. There's historically been that confusion, but the divine counselor is saying, think about it, okay? Don't go backwards for understanding. Go forward. You know, and that's why he purposely capitalized that S. So that if you're a student of the Bible, you go, well, I don't remember there being a capital S in there.
That's the first thing I thought.
Yeah. But, and the reason I said that is because I know none of you thought of that. Because none of you are biblical scholars.
Right.
And that's not, you know, any deficit. You're just not a biblical scholar. This is written for someone who's a biblical scholar. Right. Who will recognize, wait a minute, whoever did this capitalized the S. Why did they do that? Yeah, why did they do that? Why did the divine counselor capitalize the S? To try to say, stop it. Stop going backwards. This is a perfect statement. I don't have to change any words. It's right there. Recognize it. That's the adjuster. Right there in Ecclesiastes, he's talking about the adjuster. Humans have long known about the adjusters. The mystery of mysteries. Okay? And have spoken to it. Okay, so I just wanted to stress that. I mean, that's the kind of detail that's going on here.
When Ecclesiastes was written, how many people had adjusters?
You know what? I was just going to address that. Mm-hmm.
I mean, again, just, you know, there's always been adjusters.
The guy who wrote the Ecclesiastes had.
Okay, anyway, just, that sort of stuff is going on all the time, okay? So again, I mean, if, you know, you can't, you know, you can actually look at that minutiae of detail, and there's huge things just in this one letter, okay? I mean, that's the level at which you can engage the revelation. And get great benefit from it. Okay, here, let's go first.
Up in the very first paragraph, very first little section there, where it says mysteries of mysteries.
Mm-hmm.
In the Bible, it says wonders of wonders.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing, correct?
Yeah, like, you know, they took heaven of heavens and the universe of universes. Yeah, they're always trying to use our phraseology and parallel off of it, tweak it. Yeah. Try to pick up, you know, it's like, okay, you've probably even sung a song about that. Think about it, okay? Just now just be a little bit more precise in your thinking, more literal. Don't let it just be fuzzy and platitudes and, you know, grab a hold of it literally, directly.
You know, just quickly in passing, there's a lot of subtleties in the recording of the Urantia book that are missed, especially if you want to go into this sort of a doctrinal study.
Right. We talked about that before, you know, whether or not supremacy is capitalized or not. Makes a big difference. One is deity and the other is supremacy, or is divinity, you know, lowercase s supremacy. All right, and in, you know, some of these I can remember, you know, but where all these quotes, you know, I can't hold on to that in my head. I mean, you can always get to Perimony and look up where these, you know,
right.
Dwayne spent all that time finding all that stuff, and most of the time he did a decent job. Sometimes he's... Sometimes, you know, he's not just giving you the, you know, the direct one that they're leveraging off of. I mean, he'll give other ones that are, you know, similar to, you know, which is kind of superfluous. But you know, it's all there. Use the Perimony if you want to really engage this stuff.
We are constantly confronted with this mystery of God. We are nonplussed by the increasing unfolding of the endless panorama of the truth of his infinite goodness, endless mercy, matchless wisdom, and superb character. The divine mystery consists in the inherent difference which exists between the finite and the infinite, the temporal and the eternal. the time-space creature, and the universal creator, the material and the spiritual, the imperfection of man and the perfection of paradise deity. The God of universal love unfailingly manifests himself to every one of his creatures up to the fullness of that creature's capacity to spiritually grasp the qualities of divine truth, beauty, and goodness.
Okay, notice one little thing in there. They purposely used the name the universal creator. So, you know, just subtly they're slipping in. They're trying to encourage you to not just ball it all together into the universal father. You know, if you're going to contrast with creature, you know, creator. You know, the aspect of God the Father that's in, you know, direct contrast there is the universal creator. Okay, now the big thing here should be obvious to you now. What is it saying at the end there? Okay. So, the God of universal love, God the Father, okay, unfailingly manifests himself to every one of his creatures up to the fullness of that creature's capacity. Okay? God the Father does not supply capacity. He only fills capacity. If you have no capacity, don't expect to have much relationship with God the Father. It's like, well, how do I get capacity? Do I consecrate my will to the perfect will of God the Father? No. It's the other consecration. If you haven't consecrated your mind to the universal harmony of God the Mother, all you have is your initial default capacity, and it's really tiny. It's as small as it can be and still allow personality and an adjuster and stuff. Have you grown that capacity? Now, is that the precise way to think about it? I purposely said it that way, just to see if I would get, you know.
Have you grown? We don't.
Ah, grown, right.
We supply.
Have you supplied the favorable conditions right. for it to be grown?
Right.
Right. But just, you know, keep it simple here.
Right.
It's not complicated. There's another consecration that's essential. You must consecrate your mind to the universal harmony of God the Mother. God the Mother is this space up here. You have to take delight in cultivating a relationship with the temple within, the true heart, not the so-called heart down here on the level of feelings. That's not going to get it done. That doesn't do one lick for the capacity up here. It doesn't matter how feely you are down here. Nothing changes up here. Okay? You have to take delight in cultivating a relationship with the three cosmic intuitions, with the source of capacity. God the Mother is a capacity-producing deity phenomenon. Why? You know, we mentioned it. The Mother is a downstepped expression of the association between those three facets of deity, one of which is the infinite capacity. That's why she has the ability to give you capacity, to grow you. She has that aspect of deity in her. There's a lot here, you know, we start to go into a little bit freer flowing mode, allow that worshipful state, you know, to unfold a little bit more when we go into the next section. You know, and you can go back and read this and experience that majesty a little bit more, because there's a lot of majesty in it, but I want to make sure that you see the precision in this too. Don't just, you know, try to feel the majesty. So again, that you're just down there on the second level of meaning. You know, this one of the key things in this is this part that is a way above that temple within. That you only have a relationship if you have something that goes way beyond feelings. And if it goes way beyond feelings, it's very powerful. It will result in feelings, you know. If you have this sense, well, I don't think it's valid if there aren't feelings involved. Well, yeah, there'll be feelings, but it will be as a consequence, not an end in itself. You know, if feelings feel good to you, seek out the source of feelings, not the shadow. Okay? Don't satisfy yourself with the shadow. Okay. Okay, so let's read this next paragraph.
To every spirit being and to every mortal creature in every sphere and on every world of the universe of universes, The Universal Father reveals all of his gracious and divine self that can be discerned and comprehended by such spirit beings and by such mortal creatures. God is no respecter of persons, either spiritual or material. The divine presence, which any child of the universe enjoys at any given moment, is limited only by the capacity of such a creature to receive and to discern the spirit actualities of the supermaterial world.
Okay, now you go, wait a minute. Yeah, so that's the first thought that you got me. Wait a minute. It's like he's repeating himself. Why would he repeat himself? All right, they're trying to get you to stop. Okay, yeah, relative to you, it's a repeat. They've added something in there. That paragraph's not all just about you, is it? It's about all creatures. Why is that paragraph in there? Okay, this subject comes up over and over and over and over again throughout decades of study groups. You start studying the rebellion and the default. And everyone's going, how could these, you know, relatively high beings, these Lindanadecs, Lucifer, Satan, Kalagashi, how could these Lindanadecs do what they did? And his staff, mortal ascenders, have made it all the way up to Gerasim. And then they did what they did. Nod and his crew. And Adam and Eve, tens of thousands of years, I mean, who knows how long. How could they do what they did? And all the rebel angels and the rebel midwares, these spirit beings, how could they do what they did? Okay. Is the reason that those spirit beings did what they did, is it because those spirit beings weren't spiritual? No, that's not it. They're spirit beings. Of course they're spiritual. They're more spiritual than you and I can even imagine right now. I mean, some of them. The problem is not this spiritual father issue, you know, that they're an expression of being a creature from a universal creator, a spiritual father. What's their problem? Why did they do what they did? This capacity, the capacity issue. You know, it's not that they weren't spiritual enough, it's because they hadn't taken delight in cultivating a relationship with God the Mother. They had not the capacity, the objective capacity, to handle the circumstance. The problem is not their relationship with God the Father. I mean, their relationship with God the Father fell apart, you know, consequently. But that wasn't the problem. They're spirit beings. I mean, a Lindanadec is a literal direct child of a creator, son, and creative mother spirit. That's a pretty high spirit being. Okay? Their problem is not a relationship to the Father. Their problem is a capacity. You know, so this is the serious question you've heard me bring up before. Put yourself in this position. Ask yourself a really tough question. If you were standing in front of the silver-tongued Lucifer, a spirit being who has spiritual luminosity beyond anything you've ever imagined seeing, beyond any angelic notion of spiritual luminosity, if you were standing in front of Lucifer with his silver tongue, would you have the objective capacity to withstand him? He's saying, well, but I'm spiritual. Yeah, well, that's what he's using against you. It's the fact that you're spiritual that he has power over you, potentially. If you weren't spiritual, I mean, how is a spirit being going to somehow seduce you? You know, it's your spiritual nature that he's engaging, you know?
Not only that, he's the father you've always known locally. Add that piece to it, because these guys had that.
This is a very important paragraph. You know, it's like, wait a minute, why did they repeat that? Because they're trying to give you this answer. How many times has this question come up? How have people ask this question over and over again? They've asked the question in study groups, the same person, for 30 years. Okay? And they're not getting it. Answer the question. You now know the answer to the question. And the answer to the question is a tough answer because it comes right back to you. And the challenges you see is in front of you. Have I taken delight in cultivating being something besides merely spiritual? Okay. And just think about how double-edged that spiritual nature is. I mean, if all I had was just spirit, the more spirit I have, the more susceptible I am to the spirit sophistries of Lucifer. I need that spirit in an objective context, not in my subjective mind. I need that spirit in an objective context. I need that spirit in the temple, not down in my adjutant mind. Okay. So this is the key. Yeah.
No adjusters in these spirit beings.
No adjusters. They don't need adjusters.
I understand, but
what do they have?
The ones who survived the rebellion were mostly on the magic worlds, and they were all surviving mortals. As I recall, were they not?
No. I mean, why did Van not join the rebellion? Is it because he had an adjuster? No. No. Why did Van... Why was Van's sophistry proof that Nod wasn't? They both, you know, came from mortal spheres, made it all the way up to Gerasim. I mean, aren't they, like, the same?
Yeah, they should be.
And yet they fell completely into the two sides of the binary equation. One went to zero and one went to unity. What's the difference? It's not their father likeness. It's their mother likeness. Van was wiser than Nod. Van had taken more delight in cultivating. That's why he was in charge of the 10th group. Go back and look at what he was in charge of. Okay? He was given the charge of that 10th group because there needed to be a sophistry-proof individual in that group, just in case. Well, and then just in case came about. Van stood fast. And those who looked to him and his transcendent loyalty to supreme values also stood fast. You know, those who had enough mother-likeness to identify with that mother-likeness stood fast. Okay? It's not the father-likeness. And this is the key to transitioning from the fourth epical revelation to the fifth. Now, I've said it many times. This is the key. To take delight in cultivating being more than just a spiritual being. Being a cosmic citizen. You know, having a cosmic character.
Can you give us some solid examples? Cultivating relationship.
Well, I mean, we've touched on it a little bit. I mean, the easiest thing to remember about this is to get started. All you have to do is challenge yourself to be humble and patient. Supply those favorable conditions, and she will grow you. You will begin to experience what happens. It's like, well, it can't be that simple. Shouldn't I have to do something? Well, again, what, you know, it's like, well, okay, take it a little step further. What do they tell you in paper 16, section 6? You know, you put that humility and that patience up front, and then they say, now do something. Okay, you know, those are favorable conditions for the fundamental doing phenomenon that cultivates being grown, and that's reflect. Put yourself in a reflective state of consciousness, not a meditative state of consciousness. Go beyond meditation to reflection. You know, meditation is just getting into the temple and trying to hold yourself there, you know, not falling out. You know, and it's a start. I mean, you got to find the temple, okay? But just literally meditation, a meditative state is just trying to be passively in the temple. Well, one must do something as well as be something. See? Okay, so once you figure out how to be in the temple, now do something. That's why it was built. The temple was built for doing something, not just being. It was built because it's the means of bringing the cosmos into yourself. That's reflection. Being able to begin to recognize the cosmos, your threefold recognition ability that you have up there in the temple, beginning to recognize the cosmos and beginning to take control of the self relative to that harmony of the cosmos. The self wants to think a bunch of things. Well, give it a good initial starting point. Reflect on the cosmos, figure out what the proper initial assumption is, give that to yourself, okay, and now let yourself go. Control the self by controlling its initial assumptions.
Yeah? So that would be a reason why there's value in understanding the patterns of the cosmos.
Mm-hmm.
Because we can reflect those, what we learn about that, and then apply them in our daily life.
Yeah.
Take those patterns and things and knit them into, material hands-on.
And you know you'll be able to do that. It was the very first thing we did in the very first paragraph, is notice how immediately the relationship of understanding was between understanding how the Supreme works and how you, in your relationship to your adjuster, works. I mean, if you understand anything, you understand something about yourself, because you're all part of one system. This distinction is vital for in a cosmic system. See, that, if you want to, learn how to live a better life, vital, how to live, this distinction is important to your better living. Take delight in cultivating a relationship with the cosmos. Everything that you do will benefit yourself, no matter how remote it might seem. The more you understand the universal one of infinity, the more you're supplying favorable conditions for yourself. You're not trying to think yourself into a better life. You're trying to supply favorable conditions. And the more you reflect and understand the cosmos, you can't help but bring that in to yourself. It just will happen. Okay?
Mm-hmm. So basically, the way I interpret that in my mind is that you get to a state, okay, you have these problems that are gnawing away at you in your mind. And you say, okay, I'm going to get to a self-neutral level. I'm going to, get to a patient level. In my mind, I'm going to be patient. I'm going to be neutral to all this stuff, even myself.
Mm-hmm.
And then you start to bring in that problem, and it's minus all that fear or whatever, that emotional baggage, because you've gotten up to that higher level of the neck of the hourglass, and you're bringing that in, and you're not really thinking about it, but you're kind of trying to view it with both eyes, with that reflective eye and bringing in the problem.
What's the word that they use for the kind of thinking that you do from the temple when you're looking to the self? Prayer is?
Self-reminding.
No, well, self-reminding. It's?
Sublime thinking. Yeah, sublime thinking.
Sublime thinking, okay? You're standing in the temple and looking to the self. When you neutralize the self,
right.
Now you can. You're still gonna. You're gonna allow the self to enter in, but you have this sublime relationship now.
Right.
This objective relationship.
It's not overwhelming you.
Right. All right. You can deal with the self objectively. You can make some progress here. Okay?
Yeah.
And then there's super thinking on the other side.
Worship.
Yeah. Okay. The super thinking and the sublime thinking together is reflection. Yeah. You're reflecting the two off of each other through the temple. It only can happen through the temple. Okay? It's the doorway. Okay?
The other thing they just spoke of with prayer and worship was a recharging phenomena with prayer,
mm-hmm.
and a tuning phenomena with worship.
Right. Just think about that. That's all I'm saying. It's the harmony of the cosmos. You're tuning to the harmony. It's the language is very purposeful. Okay, right.
What transforms the mind.
It's like that mind needs something. That subjective mind, that self, needs something it doesn't have. It's not going to get it from itself. It has to get it from something that goes beyond the self. And the only way that something can get to the self is the the bridge between the cosmos, which is what it needs, and the self, and that's the temple.
So that's what our will can do. It can choose to orchestrate what you just, that's the favorable conditions.
Right,
get
right.
to the temple.
Right. And initiate the process.
And then recognize two parts of the equation there.
Yeah.
And you're in the middle.
Yeah. You as a person are in the temple.
Right.
And the self is over there.
Okay.
Yeah.
You need a very simple definition of what you mean reflecting on the cosmos. Cosmos means
harmony.
The
word
of the mother's mind.
No, well, just the literally the word cosmos means universal harmony.
Okay.
That's what the word means. You know, it doesn't mean pile of galaxies. It means universal harmony.
Stars, planets.
Yeah.
Right.
It's a Greek word, and you know it also. I mean, it means the harmonizing universe too. Extensively, the word cosmos means harmonizing universe. You know, there is a, you know, there is that harmonizing universe out there. But you know that's not what we're talking about in this inner life situation. We're talking about the intensive meaning of the word cosmos. So not harmonizing universe, universal harmony. Remember, it means both universe and harmony at the same time. And so you can put one as the noun and one of the adjective as the adjective, or the other way around. Okay. Intensively, it's the universal harmony. And that's most fundamentally what the Greeks had in mind when they recognized that there was a word that needed to be coined. They recognized they were recognizing something that needed to be named. I'm recognizing cosmos. I'm recognizing universal harmony. Yeah. It's the Greek word for that. Okay.
So when you're reflecting, what are some of the thoughts that you're creating in this reflectivity?
I'm not going to try to create the self-help book here, in study group. Okay. We need to keep going here. Let's not try to answer all these questions. Remember, it's not Pam's job to answer your question. It's not my job to answer your question. It's your job to answer your question. You have to take delight in cultivating. So, I mean, just start trying to figure out what this means. Don't get me to give you an answer. No one gave me the answer. I just started trying to figure out what the heck this meant. And I've come to appreciate it. And I'm encouraging you to do likewise. Okay? You don't have to try to give voice to everything, you know, that you're figuring out. Let it be within you. Let it just grow. See if you can understand. You know, notice there's a first sentence like, wait a minute, I think I have a hold of something. Let's run with that. Let's write a book now. That's yourself taking the lead again. You're letting the self take the lead. The self wants to dot all the I's. Okay?
Wants to get all that adulation.
No. Just, you know, even if it's not looking for adulation, it's you know, it wants to run. The self wants to run. You know, if mom lets go of the kid's hand, what does the kid do? Okay? If you let go of yourself's hand, the self's going to run. Don't let go of it. Hold on to the self's hand. Keep it there. Teach it patience. Let it slowly develop over time, the understanding. Don't try to immediately understand. I mean, I know that's going to be frustrating, but that's part of the process, to allow it to just slowly go somewhere. Just be patient with it.
I've got this little reminder on here. It says, Creator, make us more responsive to your gracious leadings.
Excuse me. What I'd like to do, you said I didn't have
having
answer.
Said,
I want to answer. The way I look at it is, when I am faced with a lot as it's going along, my litmus test, is this of truth, beauty, and goodness? If it's of those three qualities, those three values, then I know that I'm living the right way. I know I'm following. So I feel that way he can grow. I can grow.
But my problem is I can't get out of the reflectivity piece. It's not going anywhere.
And just remember that no matter how helpful that may be to you, it may not be helpful to her.
And that paragraph before.
Yeah, but it says a lot of things
in
this. Sure, it says that. It says a lot of things in the book, though, and you know, and you, everyone has to figure out where to start with themselves.
Yeah, I like that. But I have like been in this reflectivity mode for months and months and months, and I'm going to try the, instead of picturing stars and planets,
right.
I'm going to picture
right.
harmony.
Harmony is the key.
Maybe
stars,
that's why I'm
stars. You were reflecting on stars and planets.
Well, that's what I thought the cosmos was.
Okay.
I had no idea.
Reflectivity is not the problem.
Right. That's why, you know, for years and years and years, I've been defining that word cosmos. You know, almost every time it comes up, I bring this up. You know, is it, you've got to understand that. I mean, you know, when that's a great example of a word that's used extensively in the book that has the potential for more distortion of meaning. If you don't understand what the revelators mean by cosmos, I mean, you know, when they talk about cosmic consciousness, you're going to start writing all kinds of gobbledygook books and stuff. Okay?
Where do they find it in the book?
I mean, it again, see, that's one of the neat things about it. You know, there isn't a spot in the book.
Right. It's all over.
It's all over, and you can go to a dictionary, a good dictionary. You can look up the etymology of the word cosmos, not the definitions. You can look up the etymology of the word cosmos. What were the Greeks talking about when they coined this word? They had something in mind when they coined this word. Was it bananas? Was it rutabagas? Was it laptops? You know, what were they thinking of when they coined this word? Was it galaxies? No, they didn't know about galaxies. What was in their, you know, what concept was in their mind that they coined a word for? And you'll see that it means both universe and harmony. They wanted a word that meant both of those things simultaneously. And then you go, well, why would you do that? Why wouldn't you coin a word for universe and a word for harmony? Why would you muddle the waters and create a word that meant both universe and harmony? Because they weren't just talking about harmony, like, doong, you know, some perfect, you know, chord on a piano, okay? They weren't just talking about harmony, they were talking about universal harmony. What's the difference between harmony and universal harmony? Universal harmony is objective, because it's universal. If you have any relationship to universal harmony, instead of just some harmony that you create within, some sort of self-righteousness, you can have a very harmonious self-righteousness. But it's not objective, it's wholly subjective. You're looking for a universal harmony. Yeah, and that's the thing that's, I mean, lots and lots of people had used harmony before, but for some reason the Greeks coined a new word. They didn't just use that old word for harmony. They coined cosmos because they recognized that there was something beyond just relative harmony. There was objective harmony. Yeah. I should say beyond subjective harmony. Yeah.
So the problem is a lot of people, when they look at the Urantia book, they'll say, oh, it's a bunch of gobbledygook because it's talking about cosmos. And they're like, oh, it's... Like, I know that sometimes people have thought that it's a good idea to present the Urantia book, to enhance cosmic consciousness, right?
Mm-hmm.
And but to a non-reader, somebody who doesn't know anything about the book, they'll be like, what the hell does that mean?
Mm-hmm.
You know? Cosmic consciousness, it sounds like took LSD or something, or I don't know.
I mean, I often, the way I remind people of how muddled that word gets, you know, is, you know, it's not talking about cosmic, okay? You know, it's not the way a lot of people use. You know, people love to use the word cosmic. Ooh, that's a cool word.
Yeah.
Let's use that word. Let's call everything cosmic.
Oh.
You know, and it'll sound really cool. Like we're really doing something profound here. See, again, there's just the revelation is not for those people. Those people have no avenue into the revelation. There has to be some sort of integrity that you've challenged yourself relative to in order to have a doorway into the actual revelation. You know, if you just like to write books that use the word cosmic and cosmos because you think it sounds cool and very New Agey, You might stumble upon the Urantia book and, wow, this book uses my favorite word. Let me kind of leverage, you know, my whole cosmic agenda off of the Urantia book. That's affirmation. You're using this book as affirmation, not as revelation. Yeah. And so you have to turn it around. Notice, how do you turn something around like this? If you've got it 180 degrees out of whack, the problem is humility wasn't the first step. Yourself and its agenda were the first step. You know, you wanted to be a new age thinker and write books about cosmic things. You know, it was your agenda that you were putting first. You're not a truth seeker. You're a self, you know, revealer. Wait just a second. We come across this sort of stuff all the time, and it's just, you know, I hate to repeat this over and over again, but it's just extremely important that you recognize, when you're reading something and you go, wait, I think I know what that word means, it's almost guaranteed that you're 180 degrees out of whack. Okay? Pretty much guaranteed. I mean, if you think you understand that because you've studied what someone has said about that, it's extremely likely that you're 180 degrees out of whack, no matter how many books they've written. Because that's the whole point of the revelation. You know, if we had something really solidly out there figured out, they wouldn't talk about it in here. They can't. You know, sort of grab a hold of that and, you know, and run it forward. It's like, no, you have a good grip on that. You can take that forward. It would be a violation of the revelatory mandate for us to take you forward along that line. So, you know, just notice that. If they're talking a lot about cosmos, that means we're clueless about cosmos. Okay? And they can freely talk about that. You know? Right. It's exactly, you read my mind. You knew I was going to bring that up next. That's a simple example. I mean, the geologic timeline. If they, you know, they talk extensively about such and so happened at such and such a date, such and so happened at such and such a date.
How much hand-holding did they do
If we could know that stuff, that couldn't be in there. So the very fact that they talk so much about it means that we are seriously confused about that and cannot fix that confusion without revelation. That's why there's revelation about that.
And a lot of people cannot get past that.
I mean, and think about how disappointing that is to yourself that's fundamentally lazy. You know, like, wait a minute, I'm going to have to really work. Taking delight in cultivating is going to be work. Yes, it is. You know, to do something as well as be something is going to take serious effort. You know, and as soon as I say effort, a sequence of 8 words should pop into your head. Effort, struggle, conflict. Okay? As soon as you start efforting, a process begins. You go from effort to struggle to conflict, inexorably.
And that's creating the favorable condition.
And yourself kind of knows that. And that's why it doesn't like the effort. Because it doesn't want, because it's too lazy to deal with the conflict that it knows is going to ensue. And the
ease-seeking.
The conflict doesn't have to be between two individuals. It's not like you're going to come into, you know, conflict with another nation or something. Okay? It's going to be an internal conflict. You're going to come into conflict with a preconceived opinion, a settled idea, or a long-standing prejudice, guaranteed. The moment you start efforting, the moment that you sincerely begin to effort, God jumps in there. The angels even start jumping in. It's like, ooh, I can make a rugged hill out of that. Yeah, wait till you see the rugged hill I've got built for you now that you're efforting.
Bring your water bottle.
You know, it's going to get steeper and steeper until it starts to, you know, you start to struggle, and then it's going to get steeper and steeper until you come into conflict, because that's the whole point. you know, to get yourself to a point of an internal conflict at least, you know, forget about the external for the moment, but to get yourself to that internal conflict point where now you've got a choice to make. Are you going to back up? It's like, I knew that's why I didn't effort. It always leads to conflict. I hate conflict. I like
almost as much as struggle.
I like my passive, self-satisfied state. I'm going to go right back to where I was, and I'm not going to do that again. Or are you going to go to that next step in that sequence of eight words? Effort, struggle, conflict,
faith,
recognition. You know, in a more complete sense, you know, faith is one of the three recognitions. Personal recognition, okay? All the recognitions in play. You know, when you get to conflict, are you going to actually go to the temple within to resolve this conflict? Are you going to go to the place where you can get some objective perspective on the conflict and recognize the resolution of the conflict rather than avoiding the conflict? You know, you avoid the conflict, you know, you're moving up in the levels of meaning and you get into conflict. You know, are you going to go back down where it's comfortable? Or are you going to keep going up, you know, into the temple where you can recognize, okay? And one, if you recognize, I recognize how I can go over that conflict. Because that's, you know, a true conflict, you can't go through it, you can't go around it. All you can do is go back once you came, or you can go up. You know, and you take that recognition step and you go up. You know, and when you recognize that you can go up and go over that conflict, then you have a whole new determination that you never had before. The faith that you're using there is not the faith that you had before. The faith that you had that, you know, that allowed you to get started is not the faith that's going to get you through the conflict. You have to grasp anew. You have to bring new faith into play, new recognition, new grasp in order to get over that conflict. There wouldn't have been a conflict if you had what you needed to start with, the faith that you started with. This is a new faith. Okay? And when you take that step, you know, exercise new recognition, new faith, you know, have this whole new determination, you know, then you can get through to the end point. What is it? So effort, struggle, conflict, faith, determination, love, loyalty, progress. You want to get to that progress. The conflict didn't stop you, you progress. But you have to get that key step to being able to have, you know, the new degree of love and loyalty, you know, is predicated on having the capacity, just like we were reading here tonight, that recognition. See, that's that capacity step. If you don't have the capacity, you can't resolve the conflict. It's unresolvable in that small of a space. If you've taken delight in cultivating a greater relationship, when you go to that objective domain, you do have the capacity to overcome that conflict. You know, and you'll discover in that greater capacity is a greater degree of, the capacity to spiritually grasp the qualities of divine truth, beauty, and goodness. Okay? If you want more truth, beauty, and goodness, you've got to have more capacity. It's not magical. Yeah. You know, if you want to have that greater, you know, relationship to the God of love, that step, that love, that determination, love, see, it was preceded by the capacity. That, like I said, see, that's why it's a new faith. It's a bigger, you've grasped a hold of a bigger space. Think of that faith grasp, see, literally. You've literally grasped a hold of a bigger space. And now there's a potential to resolve conflict that you never had before.
Yeah. I just think that a lot of people for a lot of people, that conflict gets stuck on their inability to comprehend death and why a loving God would create a universe that involves our dying.
Right. That's why, you know, why do we all die? It's a very important conflict point that we're forced to come to terms with. No matter how much you want to, you know, whistle past the graveyard, eventually you get old. And it's just, you know, coming inexorably towards you. You know it is. You've got to deal with it. And if you can, you know, if you can recognize, you know, the answer to those questions, like you just, you know, brought up about the loving God and this whole conflict. If you can recognize, then you can realize. That whole bit of love, loyalty, you know, loyalty to supreme values, for instance. You know, if you actually have loyalty to supreme values, you've gone past recognition to realization. You know, it's now something that isn't just seen. You know, it has been realized within you. Your personality has a hold of this, and it's created a whole new measure of harmony within you that you didn't have before. You're moving one step closer to the peace that passes all understanding. You know, and the relationship between death and peace is obvious. You know, can you get to the point where you're at peace with death? For most people on this planet, that's a peace that passes all understanding. Death invokes nothing but terror, not peace. It's a very sharp blade, you know, of conflict that if you can get at peace with, you've really taken a big step beyond what most people on the planet are at. Most people, when death is, you know, confronting them, they're howling at the moon or something, you know, if they have any ability to. Let's read the last paragraph. Maybe we'll do it just a little bit more, and then we'll wrap it up here.
As a reality in human spiritual experience, God is not a mystery. But when an attempt is made to make plain the realities of the spirit world to the physical minds of the material order, mystery appears. Mysteries so subtle and so profound that only the faith grasp of the God-knowing mortal can achieve the philosophic miracle of the recognition of the infinite by the finite, the discernment of the eternal God by the evolving mortals of the material worlds of time and space.
Right there is that faith grasp. And it does not say of the God-believing mortal. It says the God-knowing mortal. And there's nothing but difference between the two.
That's God consciousness.
Yeah, right. God knowing more. The only person that can know God is the person who's taken delight in cultivating a relationship with what's in the temple within. Okay? You can believe in God on the level of feelings. You can believe with all kinds of fervor. I mean, you know, on one end of the level of feelings is reverence. So you can have deep, deep reverence. But that's just feeling. It's just the level of feelings. You know, and that reverence for God, you know, can you know, foster a, you know, a very deep belief in God. But God knowing is a different matter altogether. Yeah?
And that's a little number that you cannot explain to people.
All you can do is just encourage people to keep efforting. You know, I can't convince you that there's even anything up here from the vantage point down below. We've talked about that many times. I mean, the level of feelings, the second level of meaning, okay, is a distinct level below the level of patience, which is in the neck there. You know, it's far enough below that when you stand on the level of feelings and look up, it doesn't look like there's an opening. It seems to go to a point above. And that's why people don't even try to go there. It's like, well, there's nothing there. It just goes to a point. You know, it's a leap of faith, quote unquote, you know. She's like, don't go with your eyes. Just take a step up.
Go with your heart.
Go with your heart, yeah.
Well, see, go with...
That's your feeling.
Right, right. But see, you know, and you say, well, go. Well, I'm trying to get to the heart. How could I go with my heart? Well, see, there's this, you have a tiny little unrecognized relationship to the Holy Spirit by grace alone. There's a tiny little relationship to the heart. One tiny little fingernail of you is already up there, okay, in the heart. You know, it has been since you were roughly age 6. By and large, people, you know, are completely unaware of this fact. But see, if you just let go, there's this little faint flicker of relationship that you can draw upon that will allow you to take that step, you know, and actually choose to go up there, not just take it for granted that, you know, your mind is stable and sane. See, the only reason it's stable and sane is because you got that little link, that little thread of connection that the mother gave you by grace. Okay, use that little thread of connection, that little thread of grace to take this step, you know, just step up. Start to take delight in cultivating a relationship with that which, by and large, it's sad to record that so few persons really know anything of.
What's the definition of faith again?
Personal recognition. And see, that's that faith grasp. And that's what I was trying to allude to. You have this little thread of connection, or however you want to think about it. You have this little measure of existence up there in the temple already. That's sort of like a super conscious connection, by and large. You're not really conscious of it. As a 6-year-old, you're not conscious of being in the temple. But there's a little measure of you that's up there super consciously. Okay? Grasp a hold of that. Use that initial gift from the Father in relationship to the initial gift from the Mother to grasp that, to get yourself, you know, by choice up there. Choose to go up there beyond that initial measure of grace.
What's that quote, sharing your inner life more or less than...
Right. Doing the will of God is nothing more or less than an exhibition of creature willingness to share the inner life with God. Okay? In order to share the inner life with God, it's up here. That's the only place that you can share. You can't share it down here. You can imagine you're sharing your inner life with God down on the level of feelings, but you're not actually doing it. You can only share where God is. God is up there in the temple, like we just read. The mystery of mysteries is happening up there in the temple.
For a subjective individual, that's a leap of faith.
Yeah, it is. I can speak for hours and not convince you. It's like, no, I can't convince you of it. Just try it. Try it. You'll like it. I guarantee. Just try it. You know, so, I mean... And once you actually muster the courage, remember it's courageous and independent cosmic thinking. It takes courage to step to some place where you don't think there's a place to put your foot. It takes courage to take that first step, and it's going to take courage to take every other step too. But that's again, why is courage down in the lower domain? See, because you need it to take the first step up. You're given everything you need by grace. You know, you're given a relationship with the sixth adjutant that would give you, a zeal that would motivate this in the first place. You're given the courage it's going to take to step where that to a place where you can't see. You're given a little bit of an ability to step into there, an initial encirclement with the Holy Spirit by grace alone. You're given a personality by grace. You're given everything that you need to start it by grace. But that's all you're given, is what you need to start it. Everything beyond that you have to choose. You aren't just going to be given more truth, beauty, and goodness. You have to choose to create the capacity for more truth, beauty, and goodness. And until you choose a greater capacity, all you'll just have is the original measure of relationship to truth, beauty, and goodness. And no matter how much you try to exalt that initial thimbleful, it's not going to get you through really difficult situations. It'll get you through the things that a six-year-old needs to get through. Now, that's, you know, she gave you enough to handle your six-year-old problems. But she didn't give you enough to handle 40-year-old problems. You have to have chosen to have that much relationship to truth, beauty, and goodness. Wait, here, one here. Joan hasn't got any one.
Don't you think that there are, in our culture, that when you speak of heart, that people associate that with feelings?
Yeah, that's my point. That's the challenge here. Up against. It's like, no. I know what heart is. I've read dozens of books on it. It's feelings. You know, and when I read what it says in the Jesus paper about the level of feelings, I know what they're talking about. I know they're talking about heart. See, if you take that as your initial assumption, you're just not going to understand what they're talking about. Yeah. So you've discovered the revelation. You can interpret it based upon what you think the word heart means, but you're going to misinterpret it. Yeah, you have to first recognize what heart actually means, then interpret what the revelation is saying. You know, recognize first what spirit really means. It doesn't mean breath, right, even though the dictionary says that. Right. It doesn't mean breath. What does it actually mean? And I've tried to point that out. You know, there's nothing in the dictionary that helps you with that, not even the etymology, because no human has a clue what the word spirit means.
That's why they help us.
Yeah, that's why you... Right. At least with the word cosmos, you can look up the etymology, and it says universe and harmony, and it gets you started. Okay? But spirit, the dictionary, and everything that's ever been written has nothing to offer you relative to that word. No one has ever known.
Of course, personality.
And personality. No one's ever known that. That's what we'll read about next week.
We talk about it a lot.
Yeah.
We didn't have
to get into that. Okay.
When I do the work, when I wrap my rind, I'm even getting the dictionary out, mm-hmm. Because I've been reading this for years, for decades, and I'm just assuming I know what that word means. But see, I'm picking up stuff right
now. If you're reading and a really good dictionary is beyond arm length, you're not reading.
Right. Once you do the work, like even on a sentence or even on a word, and you do the work, then the worship comes in. You've created the capacity, and then the worship comes and fills it.
You've heard me say it a million times, and it's wonderful, when you describe actually your direct experience with that. I mean, if you just do the work on a single sentence. Yeah, I guarantee you, if you do the work, you'll go, cool.
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool. And as soon as you have that state of mind that's trying to express itself with something like, whoa, or cool, or something like that. See, there's more capacity there. You've just created more capacity. But it doesn't happen until you put that effort into it. And the simplest things do it. Getting the parimony out, actually looking up where that Bible quote came from, looking up the Bible quote, noticing the difference between the Bible passage and what the divine counselor wrote, and going, oh, I see what he's doing there. Okay, there's truth. Before there was no truth. You had no relationship to any of the truth of the paragraph. As soon as you go, oh, now there's some truth flowing, and something's going to happen. It doesn't happen automatically. You can't just expect, God the Father to say, well, she's reading the book, so I'm going to do everything else for her.
Yeah.
That's not the way it works.
Oh, why not?
It's just not the way it works.
Maybe the first.
All right.
Reminds me that... the teacher who was at the Boulder School, the professor.
Maren
Horn? No.
Waddles, Jeff Waddles?
Yeah. I remember once he said that when you pray, let's say you're praying for some circumstance, that you have to do everything that you're humanly capable or able to do before that prayer can be answered, you know, with something additional. You mean, we can't think of prayer like magic, that we have to do what we're humanly capable of doing before other assistance can come to us.
Prayer is a big favorable condition thing. I mean, even the most primitive of prayer gives you some measure of favorable condition. That's why the life carriers actually program that into you. You're designed to pray. Okay? Because it's even in the most primitive of minds, it gives you some measure of favorable condition.
It mobilizes psychological force.
You know, just think about why. It's like if it does nothing else, it's indicating some small measure of humility that you would actually turn to even some magical something or other in prayer. I mean, there's some measure of humility coming into play there. Okay, well, let's wrap it up there. But I just want, you know, one last little thing. This whole bit about the recognition step, notice they used that word right at the end there. The God-knowing mortal can achieve the philosophic miracle. Remember, this is a philosophical, uplifting revelation. The philosophic miracle of the recognition of the infinite by the finite. See, that cosmic consciousness that can recognize. Even though you're finite and can't rationally understand the infinite in all of its infinity, you can recognize the infinite. You've been given that ability. Take delight in cultivating it. And from a human historical standpoint, that recognition that that little child of God has is miraculous. Because from a purely rational rationalization scheme, thinking, a concept of philosophy, notion of what philosophy is, you know, there can't be some sort of objective recognition. You know? But something can be self-evident. No proof process required. It's just self-evident. That's what you're going after. A state of consciousness that just seems miraculous to those subjective minds that are struggling. Yeah.
You know, an experience that I've heard men express, that this recognition of the infinite often has to do with when they become fathers for the first time.
It's a favorable condition. You know, that's why it's one of those, raising children is one of those two things that you can't substitute for in any way between here and Gerasim.
Yes, we know.
Right. There's just so much favorable condition to that. All right. Why don't we wrap it up there? So as we go into the to the reflection time here, remember that the recognition is the key. That's what you see when you close your eyes. See what you can recognize, in the wake of this evening's discussion. Let's take a moment here.